This is another reading by Laura Vandernoot Lipsky. One evening, deep in winter, I had a car brimming with swim team kids. It was my turn to drive everyone home. The afternoon was a whirlwind, and nothing had gone as planned. I apologized to the wet swimmers, reeking of chlorine, and explained that I needed to stop quickly and pick up takeout food. I ran from my car into the restaurant and stopped abruptly at the hostess station. The young woman looked up and asked if she could help me. I told her I had an order, I was very late picking it up, and she said, "Great, what's your name?" I stood there. She looked at me. I stood there some more. I finally said, "That's a great question." I could not remember my name. As those words left my mouth, one of the women seated at the bar to my right spit out her drink, laughing. My name came back to me. I got my food, and I turned to leave feeling very unnerved. The hostess called after me, "Good luck, you know, with your name and everything." As overwhelmed as someone would need to be to forget their name, I admit I can relate, and I heard you laughing, so I know I'm not alone. The backdrop of life in a relentlessly busy culture can be disorienting and stressful. We contend not only with individual flukes of momentary forgetfulness, but with an abundance of evidence about how much our social order, our whole system, is overwhelmed. For example, I recently read about a study on the growing concern that is continuous partial attention. It showed that the mere presence of smartphones damages cognitive capacity, even when the device is turned off. Or, did you know this? 67% of couples experience a precipitous decline in relationship satisfaction in the first 3 years of a baby's life. Furthermore, another study shows that the trauma associated with anti-immigration scapegoating can be passed to infants. After babies born to Latina mothers within 37 weeks of an immigration raid in Ohio, had a 24% greater risk of low birth weight and an increased risk of preterm birth. Oh, and I also just heard that inequality in mental well-being is greater among people who report limited access to green areas compared with those with good access. I could go on, but I won't, because it's hard to hear. We already know a lot of distressing information. The level of basic overwhelm in our society has reached the threshold of widespread trauma. Overwhelm is impeding our happiness, health, spiritual growth, and very survival. In the book, The Age of Overwhelm, Strategies for the Long Haul, this is the fellowship's recent all-congregation read, author Laura Vandernoot Lipsky says that the key to coping with overwhelm and rejecting it as an automatic way of life, even if we are still wrestling with real challenges, is less distraction and more intention. As the founder of the Trauma Stewardship Institute, she has experienced and researched a host of ways that people can actually accomplish this shift from overwhelm and distraction to more intention and calm. She says we start this process by just simply monitoring our exposure to that which is overwhelming. If you voiced a burden in our litany during Joys and Concerns, that's part of doing this work. Make sure that you keep giving yourself permission to really notice what those burdens are. It's not always easy or obvious what precisely is adding the most or the worst tension in life. Sometimes we have to be detectives. Once we identify some causes of distress, then we can focus on absorbing our stressful experiences. Not absorbing in the sense of taking them on, but breaking them down and neutralizing them. Research suggests that the feeling of being inundated is processed most effectively when tended to daily. And I like that Vanderut Lipsky interprets this as daily-ish, because we're all busy. In this process of absorption or refinement, there will be roadblocks. Anyone who says de-escalating tension is easy is naive at best, or very likely trying to sell you some quick fix that will actually just add to the overwhelm. It will help avoid derailment to ask this piercing question: what are our stumbling blocks to monitoring and addressing overwhelm? Where is this hardest? Three common examples are scarcity tunnel vision, when we can't wrap our minds around the idea that a different way is possible. Guilt, when we may occupy a place of privilege such that we feel that we, of all people, have an obligation to take on more and more and more and more. Worthlessness, when we believe that we are not valuable if we are not busy and productive, with a narrow definition of what it means to be useful. These seem like obvious examples to me because I fall victim to them so easily. Every time I am confronted with a huge pile of elementary school permission slips, I feel overwhelmed to the point of total collapse. I have yet to literally fall over. I said yet, so don't rule it out. But it triggers a sense of doom that I will always be this frustrated. Oh, hello, scarcity tunnel vision. Embarrassment that I'm overwhelmed by something so trivial when children are in cages and my species is hell-bent on making this beautiful planet uninhabitable for our near descendants. That would be guilt. And the conviction that getting myself worked up over a mundane task clearly means I will not be able to contribute anything important to this world. Oh, look, there's good old worthlessness. Your issues, your stumbling blocks, your triggers, they might be different. Clearly, I have no business judging. But do figure out your version. What internal barriers keep you from addressing your places of overwhelm with clarity and compassion? Then you're ready for the next phase, pursuing strategies to actually manage overwhelm. At one of the book discussion opportunities Deb and I hosted, those who attended listed their techniques that have been helpful in relieving stress, many of which are also explored in the age of overwhelm. We talked about sleeping as a very first line of defense, embracing the concept of not my monkey, not my circus. Your therapist and Instagram memes just call this having boundaries. They're good to have. Knowing who your people are, showing up for them, and letting them in when you have need. Laughing, one of the fun things about this book is the inclusion of a lot of really good comics, and I picked a handful to show you. Two people are gazing at a mountain vista, and one says, "The majestic way they climb higher and higher until they seem to kiss the sky reminds me of the huge pile of work I have waiting for me when I get back." One jogger says, "I can't even begin to work out until I find the right news to infuriate me." Okay, the setting is at a bar, and the person with the cone says, "It keeps me from looking at my phone every 2 seconds." "It's too late, Roger. They've seen us." I was given a brief education between the services about baseball positions. I think this is the pitcher saying to the catcher, or the catcher saying, "These are some baseball people talking to each other." And one says to the other, "Your inability to turn off your critical voice, combined with your fear of disappointing your overbearing, demanding father, is causing you to lose faith in your fastball." This is my favorite. Two soldiers facing an angry army. And one says, "Maybe you shouldn't send out emails when you're tired." Other overwhelm management strategies include playing in the dirt, letting soil come in contact with your body, practicing humility. You don't know everything, and that's actually okay. Filtering news, and even unplugging, especially for predetermined periods of time. And the walkaway power, which I expanded into the Wonder Box's getaway power. Vandernoot Lipsky talks about the practice of admiring art as a tool to combat overwhelm. But I find real relief and recharge in actually creating art, which research confirms is healthy for me, whether or not the art is objectively good. Isn't that reassuring? The sense of release I get playing with clay, that's my chosen medium, pottery, is literally the opposite of the gloom I experience in permission slip mode. During our book discussion, we also reflected on the role of silence in responding well to stressors. It's easy, for me at least, to pave right over silence when I'm anxious or sad. It strikes me that we can even give it too short attention here at the fellowship. We always have 1 to 2 minutes of quiet after the joys and concerns. And then we have this tiny, minuscule, almost moment between the sermon and congregational response. What if we drew out that second silence a little more, coaxing it into enough time for a full breath? Maybe even a few. We're going to try that today, and we will invite our Buddhist gong to mark the silence for us, with us. It's a modest tweak, but let's notice where, or even if, it helps us decompress and reflect as we move to congregational response. After all, says poet Victoria Erickson, clarity is rarely loud. Most of it streams in slowly and over time. It is quiet, yet steady and sure, like seasons or rain. These strategies can help address the depletion of constant overwhelm, especially when practiced long term. They can loosen up that feeling that what you're doing is always wrong. Here we have arrived at my main point. We have to build stamina and conserve strength for the challenges that don't just evaporate when the right technique is applied, like the climate crisis or that dental bill. Overwhelm is real. It's not our fault. It's not something we can solve. We need to use all the tools and tips we can assemble as leverage to make life as livable as possible. We each deserve that. This book offers many helpful resources, yet there is a limitation that deserves our attention. Vandernoot Lipsky delivers a thoughtful critique of how the patterns of overwhelm are structural. They're bigger than we are, woven into policy, law, practice, culture, institutional life. But the solutions she suggests are all individual. Think about the ones lifted up this morning. Their power is that each of us can actually do them by ourselves. They have the potential to be personally transformative in that if I do them, they might transform me, or Deb, or you, or you. But what about that big picture, that collective we? The author doesn't attempt to grapple with that question. That is disappointing. And it is where the we of the fellowship community can show up. After all, none of us identify overwhelm, neutralize stress, enact calming strategies, and keep on keeping on in a vacuum. Where do we learn how to do this? Who teaches us by example and error and in friendship? What systems can spread hope and sanity in the face of social meltdown or decay? That happens here, not perfectly, but consistently. This process of learning about how to survive and thrive in a community that encourages that learning to be shared and spread is actually my best working definition of what it means to be a place that engages in pastoral or spiritual care. According to the organizational chart, it's one of the main duties in my job description, and it's also the guiding principle of the pastoral care team. These individuals who represent the collective commitment to be with us all as fellow learners and teachers of the hard and overwhelming stuff. I hope you will think of me and of the care team and of the fellowship itself as a resource for being in it for the long haul. We need you. Trauma and overwhelm don't get ameliorated easily or quickly, but we as individuals, and we as a fellowship community, we have staying power too. I'll close with this prayer by my colleague Elizabeth Nguyen called "For When I Really Don't Want to Learn This." Spirit, I would really rather not learn this. Didn't think I needed to. I thought someone else could do it. Thought a leader was coming to do it. Thought the young people could do it, or the elders could do it, or the professionals, or I don't want to learn it, because it means letting go of something I hold dear. Letting go of being someone who knows the answers. Letting go of being someone who doesn't know. Letting go of the way I see the world. Letting go of how I might have to change. Letting go of certainty, of logic, of facts, of control, of the myth that you can live on this earth and not harm, or the myth that I can't learn anything new. Spirit, help me to learn it, please, and then help me to live what I have learned and do right by the gift of being taught.